The clerk will call the next case.
Kenner versus Commonwealth, Dell M. Brown, Appellant's Counsel, Leah A. Darren, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth. Please allow up to 30 seconds for transfer.
All right. Ms. Brown, you may proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia. I hope everyone can hear me very well.
Yes, we can.
Good. Again, I am before the court this morning. First, I want to thank the court on behalf of Mr. Lenny Rock Kenner, whom I represent on these two assignments of error which have been granted by the court. I again thank you for the opportunity for this oral argument. The first assignment of error I'd like to address is the Court of Appeals erring in affirming the trial court's decision as to the introduction of child pornography that was found on the computer of the bedroom of my a client. This started as a jury trial, obviously, and there were three charges before the court, and very briefly in terms of the facts, a jury trial was had. The three charges was the animate object sexual penetration, aggravated sexual battery, and custodial sexual. My client received a sentence of life plus 7 years. This started off with a child known as DT who went to the home of my client and his fiance, Miss Robinson, and during the time that this child was basically dropped off by the mother who had her own personal issues. The child, upon the return to her mother, indicated that she had been abused sexually by Mr. Lenny Rock Kenner. The assignment of error in number one deals with the evidence of the child pornography. Looking specifically at Rule 2403 of the Rules of Supreme Court of Virginia about the relevance of evidence, and also looking at Rule 2:403-404 about the whether or not these the evidence that was taken from the computer would have been relevant to this case. I would tell the justices today that at the outset the evidence was wholly prejudicial, and although interesting and maybe somewhat relevant, I would tell the court that not all evidence was not all evidence that is before the court is relevant, and we believe the trial court as well as the Court of Appeals erred in allowing the child pornography to come in.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? Am I right that the victim stated that during some of the instances of sexual abuse, the defendant had her watch his computer and watch pornography on his computer while they were together during these criminal events or some of the criminal events? Is my recollection right?
That is right, Justice Kelsey.
Well, then my next question is this. I don't even know why we're talking about instances of bad acts. That computer is an instrumentality of the crime. It's no different from dropping a handgun as you walk away from shooting somebody.
Respectfully, I beg to differ. Although it may be distasteful to some people, adult pornography is legal. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that, based on what was heard at trial, that the child, you know, should have been subjected to that, because there were other things that the child said that she saw on the computer that she also found distasteful or she didn't like the scary movies. She said there were a lot of.
Now, my point is that she said, as I understand it, but correct me if I'm overreading it, that during some of these sexual assaults, part of the drill was to put her on his lap and for the two of them to watch pornography on his computer. Now, if there's pornography on his computer, whether it's child pornography or animal pornography or whatever he's looking at, how is that not relevant?
Justice Kelly, it's not relevant because the pornography that was admitted, and as I looked at the transcript very carefully, it wasn't the content. The jury wasn't able to see the content of the video, even though the trial court had indicated that it would allow the content in. It was just the titles of the pornography. fee. And quite frankly, Justice Kelly, the titles were so disturbing, I don't think anybody could wrap their mind around the case at bar, the case that was before the court, once they heard the titles. I don't need to repeat them, they're in the transcript, but they didn't, this comes on the premise that my client says, I didn't do this. So that we're not talking about motive, we're not talking about opportunity, we're not talking about something that, we're talking about grooming a child, he says that I didn't do this. And that was the evidence at the trial court. So with the titles that are so inflammatory, I don't think any juror could get past that and be able to really focus in on the testimony that was heard after the introduction of the titles of the pornography, Your Honor.
Counsel, remind me, what was the age of the victim at this particular time?
The age was at that time 6 years old.
All right. Well, the titles included a statement about an 8-year-old girl being penetrated vaginally. About another title had the male penetrator being the babysitter. And another title said, teaching sex to a child, a daughter. Those actual titles correspond to some of the allegations of this victim. And it comes on a computer that, according to her, was something that was viewed while the incident was happening. I'm struggling to find how there's any argument at all that that's not relevant.
So I don't believe, and I stand corrected, that there was anything to indicate that those may have been the titles, but that's not what she viewed. I think she said she saw naked adults, those were naked adults, but people, grown people that didn't have clothes on, not little children. Those were the titles that the FBI special agent was able to procure from the computer, not that she had viewed those items. And in any event, as you're talking about those particular titles, the father-daughter, I just think it's so inflammatory. And I believe in assert today that once that kind of information is disclosed to the jury as part of evidence, we don't even get to intent. We don't get to any of the other parts of motive, opportunity. I mean, I think it sways the jury so much, and it's so inflammatory that it's beyond prejudicial. And although seemingly probative in the opinion of the Court of Appeals, I think it was prejudicial. And then therefore, I believe and assert today that it should not have been admitted. The case boils down to a young child's testimony versus the testimony of Mr. Lenny Rock Kenner, and that's what it was all about, not the swaying of this pornography. If I may go on, as part of the assignment number one, I also want to include, and I think I touched on a little bit, in Rule 2404, there is a laundry list of items that when you introduce a piece of evidence, you look to motive, you look to knowledge, you look to whether it negates the possibility of mistake or accident. Again, the argument before the court today is there was never any problem or issue with it being possibility or mistake or accident or some of the other nuances that I've just indicated to the court. It was always about Mr. Lenny Rock Kenner asserting his innocence, that he did not commit this offense. And therefore, the Commonwealth can't get through the back door of the crimes without coming through the front door. And what I mean by that is the evidence is so inflammatory that you had to prove each and every element of the offense. And merely by saying that he had child pornography, I believe, was too inflammatory and too prejudicial. And so again, based on that, I'm asking the court to remand this matter and overrule the Court of Appeals in its opinion and have Mr. Lenny Rock Kenner come before the court on a new trial. Any questions? Further questions? May I also at this time address assignment number two that was granted before this court? The Court of Appeals, we believe, in affirming the trial court, erred in denying the motion to have the jury individually polled once the jury came back with its verdict. I'm looking specifically right now at Rule 3A17 on jury verdicts, and that would be 3A17 little d, poll of the jury. When the jury verdict is returned, the jury shall be polled individually at the request of any party or upon the court's own motion. So after the jury had concluded, there was a verdict that was had. Now, before the jury deliberated to go back for the final determination on sentencing, I believe trial counsel made a motion to have the jury polled, and the trial court indicated that it had been too late. And I would assert today that in looking at 3A17, it doesn't say, and I understand and concede that this is a bifurcated process, and there's a lot of information, a lot of case law, and specifically looking at 3A17, how the process works. However, in the trial transcript, you all may recall that there was some consternation on the part of the trial counsel that, and looking at the jury, they were shaking heads and things that would, you know, that I believe that he would have believed that there may not have been a unanimous decision in requesting.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. When you're doing voir dire at the beginning of a criminal trial, are you allowed in voir dire to tell the jury before they sit on the case that there's a mandatory minimum if he's convicted?
No, absolutely not.
And isn't the reason for that because we don't want jurors to have the punishment issue motivate them to nullify the law on guilt or innocence? But isn't that exactly what happened here? This trial counsel waited until after the verdict, and then in speaking apparently to the jury, if I'm reading the transcript correctly, in speaking to the jury at the sentencing phase, basically invites them to be polled and says, I'll leave it to you guys after the mandatory minimum is stated. Now, if we were to allow the polling to happen after sentencing, then won't we have that argument in every single sentencing matter? And won't that be exactly what we said we shouldn't do in voir dire?
I would agree somewhat with those assertions and that the question that you're posing today. In my understanding, my take, and in thinking about what happened in this particular situation, was there was something to indicate to trial counsel that it instantly triggered for him that the jury had not been polled directly after the verdict. And outside, I believe the motion was made to poll outside the presence of the jury. And so the argument, and of course, obviously the court denied it, and our assertion was that it would have only taken moments to do that.
May I interrupt you one last time? We're running out of time.
Yes, sir. Yes.
So I may be wrong, but I thought I read that he said when he was speaking, defense counsel speaking to the jury during the sentencing phase, as you've heard, it's a mandatory life sentence, .. The one thing I would ask the jury be polled for their verdict, and other than that, I leave it to you guys. Wasn't that stated to the jury, or am I reading incorrectly?
I believe that was stated to the jury. I read that.
How is that not an invitation to take into account the mandatory minimum and get a poll of guilt after that, which is the very trick we try to keep lawyers from doing in criminal trials?
I think that's in this particular case, there was something that alerted trial counsel that there may not have been a unanimous decision. And I understand that they may have gotten a little bit more information that they should have. However, in looking at 3A17, and looking at the language of letter D, it doesn't say, even though there might be some case law and there may be thinking and legislative reasoning behind the particular part of this rule that it doesn't say he couldn't have asked for that. And again, it would have only been moments. It would have been momentarily a distraction, you know, 30 seconds, 60 seconds to poll the jury. And so based on that, Judge Kelsey and justices, I am asking the court to find that the trial court, as well as the Court of Appeals, erred in this particular assignment of error and provide my client an opportunity to have a new trial. I thank you for the opportunity today to argue on behalf of Mr. Lenny Rockkenner.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Ms. Darren.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Leah Darren for the Commonwealth in this case. I'm going to touch briefly on issue two first, going to Rule 3A17, subpart D. It talks about polling of the jury. When a verdict is returned, the jury shall be polled upon request. So it's not required, of course. And then if upon the poll, if all jurors do not agree, the jury may be directed to retire and deliberate further, or they can be discharged. In this particular case, the motion to poll the jury did not come when the guilt verdicts were rendered, but when the case had entered into the second phase of the trial, that being the guilt phase of the trial, and after the jury had already been instructed as to the punishment range for the three offenses that the jury had found the defendant guilty. And we have cited several cases from the Court of Appeals, but I point the court specifically to the Lilly case, where the court and Justice Kelsey authored that opinion when he was on the Court of Appeals. But he said this kind of activity encourages jury nullification. It encourages, it injects guilt phase issues, sentencing phase issues back into the guilt phase of the proceeding, and it is something that has categorically been prohibited, and it should be prohibited in this case. The court ruled absolutely correctly on that particular issue. If there are no questions, I'm going to move on to the other crimes evidence in this case, the issue about the admission of other crimes evidence. In this particular case, the defendant was charged, the victim in this case was 6 years old. The defendant was charged with three different crimes: indecent liberties, aggravated sexual battery, and object sexual penetration. Two of those crimes required the Commonwealth to prove lascivious intent, that is a state of mind eager for sexual indulgence, and on the aggravated sexual battery, it required sexual abuse, and sexual abuse meaning that the act was committed to arouse or sexually gratify any party. So at the very outset, the defendant was charged with crimes where the Commonwealth, regardless of the fact that the defendant said he didn't do it, was required to prove those elements. Certainly the admissibility of evidence rests within the trial court's broad discretion, and a court's ruling on an issue regarding the admission of evidence is not to be disturbed absent an abuse of discretion, which this court has said means that only where no rational jurist could have ruled as the court did is an abuse of discretion shown. In repeated cases, starting with Kirkpatrick and going through Scott and Proffitt and Ortiz, this court has recognized, as other counsel has called a laundry list of situations where other crimes evidence is admissible. And it's our position that the facts of this case check almost all of the boxes of that laundry list for the admission of the evidence. As Justice Kelsey noted, The evidence in question was on the defendant's computer in his bedroom. This computer contained personal passworded files belonging to the defendant, social media accounts, financial records. It contained adult pornography, which the defendant showed to the victim during the multiple times that he sexually molested her in his red chair in his bedroom. And it also, the FBI agents testified that computer had also been used to download and view child pornography. And while that information had been in fact deleted from the defendant's computer, the FBI were able to regenerate that based on artifacts remaining in the computer. And those child pornography videos and photographs showed children having adults having sex with children and also teaching sex to a young child. The victim in this case was 6 years old. She was the oldest child in the defendant's care. And we submit that this evidence was, as this court stated in Scott, it was so connected and led up to the offenses for which the defendant was on trial that to exclude it would have been to improperly sanitize the evidence. It also tended to show the defendant's conduct and attitude towards his victim. It corroborated the victim's testimony, and it identified the defendant as the perpetrator of the crime versus some other teenager who the defendant said could have downloaded these items and molested the child. So we submit that for all of these reasons, this evidence was relevant. And regarding
Ms. Darren,
yes,
could you elaborate for me, please, on your position that the child porn was so connected and led up to the offense, and that it ID'd the defendant as the perpetrator of the crime to the extent that the child never saw the child porn?
No, it's not our position that the child had to see the child porn. Our position is that it was on the defendant's computer. It had been deleted from his computer. The artifacts were still there so that the FBI could regenerate that. It identifies the defendant as the perpetrator. It corroborates her testimony about what the defendant did to her. The titles of these items, for example, talk about teaching children to have sex. The evidence is so connected with the offenses that the defendant simply isn't entitled to have this evidence sanitized to remove it. And I think if you look at
when you say so connected to the offenses, are you saying that the titles of the videos track the actions that the defendant took against the child? Is that what you mean when you say it's so connected?
Yes, and I recognize that could possibly be perceived as propensity evidence, impermissible propensity evidence, but that's not necessarily the case. And if the defendant had asked for a cautionary instruction, he certainly would have been entitled to that. I think other counsel's argument really boils down to that where you have evidence of this kind of child pornography in a child molestation case, it is so prejudicial that it could never be admitted regardless of its probative value. And the case law of this court certainly dictates that that's not that that that, that is not the law. I point the court to the decision in Profit, where there was a great discussion in that case, a tremendous amount of discussion in that case about probative value outweighing prejudicial effect. And in that case, this court reversed the trial court, who had excluded evidence from two victims in that case that would have corroborated the expert's testimony in that case, which that case had to do with the defendant continuing to be a sexually violent predator. But again, if you look at the rationale in Kirkpatrick, where evidence that the defendant had stolen a gun, and that evidence was admitted into a robbery case, a separate robbery case, to show that he was a participant in that robbery.
Ms. Darrow, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interject a question.
Yes.
You noted in a footnote in your brief, and I'd like you to address it, the statute that the General Assembly enacted in 2014, 18.2.67.7:1, which is clearly a propensity statute.
Yes.
Bringing Virginia law in conformity with the federal law that's applicable throughout all 50 states, saying that sexual offenses, propensity evidence is far more relevant in sexual assault cases. Can you expand upon that statute and what effect it has on our interpretation of our case law?
Your Honor, I just think I've cited that code section because in incest case, it supports our position here that in cases of child sexual assault, that the evidence, it almost flips the burden, or it flips the evidence. It says that kind of evidence comes in to prove up the case, and I think it recognizes that in child molestation cases and incest cases, any case where children are involved, that kind of evidence is probative, and it's the probative value is outweighed by prejudicial effect. So I think
that conviction for a prior crime that has absolutely zero connection in time and space and in action, a prior sexual crime involving the predicate acts of the statute that's completely unconnected to the case we're dealing with, the General Assembly is saying that is prima facie admissible. Am I reading it right?
Yes, Your Honor, you are. So we submit, for all of the reasons that we have argued in this case, that this other crimes evidence ticked virtually all of the boxes where other crimes evidence is allowed to be admitted, and that the probative value of this evidence far outweighed the prejudicial effect. So the court did not abuse its discretion by admitting the titles of these videos and photographs, and the very little bit of evidence from the FBI agent explaining what these items depicted. Are there any further questions? We ask that the defendant's convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The clerk will call the next case.